Well, it's good to start off a new year, and as we do that, we're going to start a new series, and I couldn't think of anything better to start with than talking about what I believe is the most powerful invitation that I can possibly think of, an invitation that is absolutely life-changing for you. It will forever change the way that you think, change the way that you act, change the way that you live. It's only two words. But what gives the phrase, the invitation, what gives it so much potential power in our lives is the one who says it. I'm talking about the invitation from Jesus when he says, follow me. Follow me. And I want to talk about this because I think there's a danger in our society, in churches in North America, in our day, in our time, that we talk a lot about following Jesus. We preach a lot about following Jesus. We sing songs about following Jesus. We form groups that we study and talk about following Jesus. And with all of that, sometimes the thing that we miss is actually following Jesus, is actually doing what he's asked us to do, is actually living the way that Jesus lived, is actually living in his invitation to follow him. And sometimes we think that one of the biggest threats that we have in Christianity is rebellion, that we get tempted and we get wayward and go off and choose to do all sorts of other things that we know are not good things to do. And that's a huge threat. It's a huge danger. But this, I think, is almost, it's almost worse in the fact that we can talk so much about it that we don't even know that we're missing it. We convinced ourselves that we're doing it when we're not. And if you think about this logically through, it's funny. We would never do that with other intimate invitations that we're given in life. Think about it this way. Say you decide that you found someone that you want to date. You want to get to know them better. And so you call them up. Don't text. Call them up. See them in purpose. Do it right. And you say, I really like you. I would love to get to know you better. Would you meet me at such and such a restaurant on Saturday night? And we hear the other person on the other end of the phone, and they say, oh, I would love to. I'm so excited. I'll see you there. So we get all dressed up. We smell good. We get to the restaurant. Anticipation's building. We can't wait to see that person come in and see them and enjoy the night with them. And we wait. We wait a little longer. And then we wait a little bit longer, and then we keep waiting until all of a sudden we realize that we're probably dining alone. So we phone them up, and we say, hey, I thought we had a date. What's happening? Oh, well, don't worry about it. I mean, we were on a date in my heart. You heard that in Christianity? I'm following Jesus in my heart, whatever that means. Oh, don't worry. I memorized exactly what you said to me. You said, I really like you. I would love to get to know you better. Would you meet me at such and such a restaurant on Saturday night? I memorized it. I've been thinking about it all week long, and I know exactly what you told me you wanted to do. I knew exactly the time, exactly the place, exactly what I should wear. I memorized everything. Don't worry. This week I was thinking so much about going on that date with you that I invited a bunch of friends over to the apartment. We started a study group about it. We talked all about what it would look like to go on a date with you. It's taken up my whole week. And it's ridiculous. You'd say, that's great that it's taken up so much space in your mind. But I just wanted you to come and be with me. I just wanted to enjoy the night with you. I just wanted to have dinner together. And it's ridiculous. And we would never do that with those intimate invitations, those relational invitations. And yet there's this danger that in church, sometimes we talk so much, we study so much, we memorize about Jesus saying, follow me. And we have to ask ourselves, are we actually following? Or are we actually living with Jesus the way that he's called us to live, what he's called us to do? In this series, what we want to do is talk about what it looks like to follow Jesus, what it looks like to accept that invitation on a daily basis and to live with Jesus, to be his follower. It seems simple for so many of us. It means to be a disciple, is the church language that we might use, to be a student, to give Jesus the authority in our life to learn from him, to live like him, to talk like him. And I believe that Jesus' invitation to follow him is the most profound and potential packed invitation that there is in life. Jesus offers us so much more. And he doesn't just invite us on a date. He invites us to a wedding. We're going to look at a picture of a wedding in John chapter 2. If you have a Bible and you want to turn there, John is the fourth gospel, fourth book of the New Testament, which means it's further to the back than it is to the front. If you're skimming through, the words will be behind me. In this series, we want to talk about these pictures that give us a portrait of who Jesus is and what it means to follow him. And we love pictures. We take them. We frame them. We show them to people. We post them on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter. We caption them. They show people all about our personalities, our experiences, our lives. And we want to take a glance in this series at some of those pictures that Jesus shows us of who he is, what it means to follow him. And so that's what we're going to do. John chapter 2, and I'm going to start in verse 11 before we start the story to give us some context on where we're going. It says this: "This, the first of his signs, Jesus did at Cana in Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him." We start at the end here just so that I can fill you in on the context of what's going on. It says, "This, the first of his signs." The word there used, we say first in Greek, is a word that means first, but not necessarily chronologically, not only chronologically. It's the word that we get arch from. It's the primary one. It's the big picture one. If Jesus is going to perform a sign, if he's going to show us something, this is the one that's going to give great context to everything else that he does. This is his first sign, not just chronologically, but it's the one that's going to make sense of all the other signs. Everything else is going to fall under that one big arch. And what is a sign? He does a sign. Sometimes we just quickly jump and we talk about a miracle, that Jesus does these miracles. And it might be tempting for us just to see that he's very powerful, and he is. But he doesn't just do a miracle because he's a magician or doing a trick. There's a deeper meaning here. And we know that because John here writes and he says it's the first of his signs. This is what a sign is. A sign is a display of power that points to a deeper reality. In other words, it's a miracle with a mission. Sorry, a message. Miracle with a message. It is this act, this show of power that points to something greater, something deeper. This is something that's not readily seen. And what that tells us is when we go through the details of this story and what Jesus did, we use those details to alert us to that bigger picture that of what Jesus is talking about. His message is a miracle with a message. What's the arch? What is Jesus trying to get across when he does this? And Jesus, he was Jewish. And in the Jewish scripture, or Old Testament, weddings and marriages were a primary symbol of God's relationship to his people. And so Jesus uses the setting of a wedding for his first sign because it's a picture of God's relationship with his people. He is going to show us in this moment what it looks like for him to relate to his people, how he wants us to relate to him. And you know what happens when you're engaged and you go to a wedding? For those of us who are married, you've experienced this. You look at weddings a whole different way in that time frame where you're engaged. Because when you go to a wedding, you start to look around and you start to think about all the ways that you would do it differently. You know, I like that. We would do that. Oh, but this is, I would do it different and their colors stink and we wouldn't do that. And, you know, I like that aspect, but we would change it a little bit. And you start to get the ideas. This is what I would do. This is what I wouldn't do. And we would change a couple of things here and there. And you start to compare. And what we have here in this passage is Jesus looking at the wedding that he's at, just this literal wedding. And he is going to contrast it with the kind of wedding that he wants. The kind of wedding that he wants to invite us to. And it's about relationship. It's about how he wants to live and what that wedding really means for the marriage, for how we're going to follow him, for how we're going to live. So it makes sense that the setting here is a wedding. Let's go back to verse 1, John chapter 2, and read. It says, "On the third day there was a wedding at Cana in Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus also was invited to the wedding with his disciples. When the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, 'They have no wine.' And Jesus said to her, 'Woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come.' His mother said to the servants, 'Do whatever he tells you.'" There's something kind of interesting going on here. We see Jesus' mother. It's interesting. We know what her name is Mary, but it doesn't call her Mary here in the text. And it alerts us to something important that's going on. And you saw when Jesus responds to her, we have this crisis that she points out. We're out of wine. We're at a wedding and we're out of wine. And Jesus responds to her, "Woman," guys, don't refer to your mother as woman. And that's very rude in our culture, really, to speak to anyone that way. In the first century Jewish culture, it wasn't as offensive as it is in our culture, but it also wasn't common to refer to your mom using this word, saying mother. Jesus does this, and we see in this text, and it runs throughout this book, that what's happening is that Mary is beginning this passage as Jesus' mother. That's how she's referred to. She's not named. She's Jesus' mother. And she's saying, "Jesus, they're out of wine. You know, do something." And Jesus is saying, "My hour is not yet come." His hour is referring to his death. He knows that the message that he's going to bring with his signs is going to be so scandalous, so revolutionary, that the religious leaders of his time are going to kill him for it. When he goes public with his message, it's going to lead to his death. And so he's being very careful. But what's happening here is that Mary is going from being his mother to being his disciple. And so he says, "Woman, not mother. What does this have to do with me? My hour is not yet come." And then we see that her response turns around, and she now says to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Now, Jesus is in charge, and we'll see throughout the book of John after this that Jesus' mother, Mary, she's there, she's following, she becomes a disciple, but she doesn't act so much as his mother as a follower from this point on. But here's the crisis. The wedding is run dry. There's no more wine. In this context, this is not the hugest problem in the world. I mean, we think about Jesus coming to do this sign. It says it's revealing his glory. It's heavy. This is a really big deal. He's showing his identity. And we might wonder, why doesn't he do something else? I mean, why doesn't he drop in on world hunger or poverty and mix it up? And again, Jesus knows that once he goes public, this is going to lead to his death. And so the crisis here is that they've run out of wine. In a shame and honor culture like the first century Judaism was, this was a big deal for the groom and his family. The groom's family, not like our culture where sometimes traditionally the bride's family provides the reception, it was the groom's family who was in charge of the reception to make sure there was lots of food, lots of wine, lots of dancing, lots of fun. It was a huge celebration. The entire village would come out. Everybody would be at this wedding. In these Jewish weddings, they would last some time for an entire week. As long as you had supplies and energy to do it, they would just continue to party. But they've run out of wine. And people are starting to look around and say, "Where's the wine? Is the party over? Is this it? It's run dry." Such a faux pas that some people have even said that in that culture, the bride's family would have reason to sue the groom's family for ruining the party, not having enough supplies, not being able to keep it going. And so we have this crisis. And it says so much about the kind of wedding that Jesus is contrasting. Look at verse 6. Verse 6 says, "Now there were 6 stone water jars there for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, 'Fill the jars with water.' And they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, 'Now draw some out and take it to the master of the feast.' So they took it. When the master of the feast tasted the water, now become wine, and did not know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew, the master of the feast called the bridegroom and said to them, 'Everyone serves the good wine first, and when people have drunk freely, then the poor wine. But you have kept the good wine until now.'" This is really clear. And verse 6, right up front, John, he slows down, and all of a sudden he gives us details about things that he had never given us details about before. The story slows down. We know that verse 6, something really important is happening to tell us the details that we need to know to figure this out. And here's what Jesus is doing when he performs this sign. Jesus is starting a revolution against religion. Jesus is starting a revolution against religion. Here's what I mean by religion, because when we use that word in different contexts, some of us, we're talking about completely different things. Let me tell you what I'm talking about when I say the word religion. I'm saying whatever conduit we place between us and God, whatever rite or ritual or ceremony or way of thinking, whatever it is that we think, this is what I need to go through this in order to be right with God, to get to God, that's the religious system that we've built up. It's the religious system that Jesus is going to war against. He's starting a revolution against religion. Here were these big stone jars. In Leviticus, you can read what they're used for. And stone jars were kind of the best jars for purification, for the ritual of purification, because it was thought that they couldn't become impure in and of themselves. Impurity couldn't get into them like they could a clay jar. And so they would put these things all over the place. Here at the wedding, they would stick them near the entrance, probably, where people would come in, and when they came in, they would make sure they went, and they washed, and they were purified. Many guests would go back and forth throughout the celebrations and make sure that they're pure once again. To be pure means I can now come before God. To be pure means I can now be accepted in society, in my community. And there were all sorts of purity laws, all sorts of things that would make you impure, which mean for a time, sometimes a short time, sometimes a long time, you couldn't worship. You couldn't come before God. You couldn't touch other people. It was kind of like spiritual cooties. If you touch someone else, then they get it, and then they get it, and it spreads all over the place. And so they had these purification jars. This is how I get right again. This is how I get right again. This is how I clean myself. And they were so important to the community. They were this amazing, amazingly important religious symbol. How people would relate to God. Listen, they've run out of wine. And so Jesus, looking out over the celebration, it means there's tons of empties. There's got to be all kinds of jugs they would have had the wine in, wineskins that they would have had the wine in. He could have picked anything in order to fill up some wine. He could have turned water into wine, done something powerful. But Jesus picks this very specific religious symbol, this conduit through which people would come to God, through which people would be able to identify whether or not they're in or they're out. If you're pure, you're in. If you're impure and you've done something impure, then you're out. And the things that you could do to become impure, some of them would be, you know, bad things that you do in life, hurting other people. Some things would be things you have no control over, a skin rash. And Jesus goes at this religious symbol. Understand how scandalous this is. Understand now when he was talking to his mother, he said, "My hour has not yet come." Don't you understand? When I start telling my message, proclaiming my message, this is going to revolutionize things. The religious leaders are not going to like this, and it's going to be so scandalous that they're going to kill me. You're going to be like, just to get a picture of this, we have this baptismal tank behind this wall. We baptize people, throw them under the water, bring them up again. Very symbolic. It's a wonderful thing that we do. This is what it'd be like. I come in one morning on a Sunday when we're preparing to do baptisms, and we're ready to do this wonderful symbol of people's relationship with God, and I go up the stairs in the back, and I go to check the water, because I always check to make sure it's warm, because I don't like to get in if it's cold. Yeah, it's usually warm. And I go and check it, and the whole thing is filled with beer. Could you imagine? Could you imagine me standing there? Like, I'm going to lose my job. I'm going to get fired over this. Like, what do we do? Are we supposed to drink it? Are we supposed to pass it out? Are we supposed to drain it before anybody else notices? This is scandalous, this religious symbol, this huge thing. And Jesus has taken the water and he has turned it into wine. The substance of that system, he says, I'm infusing with something good, not water, something better, wine. Wine. This system that you keep coming back to, this religion that you keep relying on, I'm going to take over and I'm going to change it. Here's why religion is so dangerous. Religion, when we talk about religion being those things that we put in between us and God, the things that we need to measure up to or do in order for him to love us or in order for us to be part of the community, religion, because it becomes exclusive, it draws that line of people that have done it and haven't done it, people who are there and not there, in and out. And on a personal level, religion makes us feel guilty. It makes us feel guilty. I've done things that I shouldn't have done. I'm wrong. I continue to do things that I shouldn't do. We also feel incompetent. Sometimes we look around and we say, and I've tried to do the good things. And I've done some of them, but I also continue to do bad things. I can't seem to do anything right. I don't measure up to the other people that are sitting in my row. I don't measure up to these Christian giants. I don't measure up to Jesus' standard of morality. I'm incompetent. I can't do it, and I'll never get it. I don't know if I can get over these barriers that I have. And finally, we feel burdened, because then we start to carry that burden on our shoulders. This is what I need to do, and I'm trying so hard, and I'm working so hard. I want to be loved. I want to do what's right. We just work. And Jesus will later say to the Pharisees, he'll say, you're loading people with all these burdens, but you won't even lift one finger to help them. And when religion is our paradigm and how we look at our life and how we look at how we relate to God and even each other, we put these barriers of who's in and out, we become burdened. We put it on our own shoulders. What can I do to make things right? And not only for us personally, but it helps us make other people feel that way. We make other people feel guilty or incompetent or burdened. We help them feel like they're not measuring up. You're not as good as me. You're not as good as us here in the church. If we took it even a step further and we looked on a larger scale, religion can lead to huge problems, and we see it in the world today. We've seen it for all of human history. People who are in and out, people who believe that I am the right one, I am good, and therefore the people who aren't like me are evil. And so religion leads on a large scale to wars. Sometimes religion leads to perpetuating cycles of poverty. People who are seen to be the social or religious elite, we have some status, and so we should be kept at the top, and even governments and policies that keep the elite, and keep the outsiders down. It leads to things like racism. We're good, they're evil. We're in, they're out. And you know, all the religions of the world, we've seen this in so many, and Christianity is not immune to that. In the times in our history of the church when we have taken our eyes off of what it truly means to follow Jesus, there have been some scary moments in the history of the church. And they've fallen into this religious pattern of us versus them, and we are good, they are evil. And some of these horrible things have happened, even in our own traditions. And so Jesus takes this deeply religious symbol, which is symbolic for so much more, and all of this religion that leads to God, this conduit that puts us right with God, and he's going to replace it. And so he fills it with wine. And not just cheap wine. I mean, this is the stuff when the master of the feast gets it and he takes it to the groom. And well, usually, people serve the best stuff right at the beginning. They serve the good wine. And then it says in our translation, I think, drunk freely. When they've drunk freely, the word really literally means when they're drunk. You know, when they've had so much that they're no longer focused on the taste of what they're drinking, then they give them the cheap stuff. But now here, you're bringing out the good stuff. This is so good. Whatever Jesus has filled this system with, now it's the best. So why does he use this symbol? Why does he use wine? Jesus uses wine as a symbol of two things here and throughout the book. The first is this. It's a symbol of God's blessing and celebration. It's a symbol of celebration, of joy. And the prophets that came before Jesus in Jewish tradition, they came and they spoke of a time that one day God is going to step into this world and he is going to be with his people, and it's going to be like a wedding feast. It's going to be like we all get together and there's so much to celebrate. We celebrate the relationship between you and me, between us and you. And they use this imagery. There's going to be food and wine and dancing. If you want to look up some of those, Isaiah 25, verse 6 and following, a great example of that. There's others, Jeremiah 21, Hosea 14, Amos 9, just a number of places where they use this imagery of a wedding feast or of wine and celebration of this time when God's chosen one, the Messiah, would show up and there would be so much to celebrate. There would be great joy. And so when Jesus fills up these jars, these religious symbol with wine, he's proclaiming a new era, a new way of living, a way of relating to God that embodies what the prophets had looked forward to, saying, now I want you to taste the good life. I want you to taste what it really looks like to be with God. And that wine is symbolic of grace. He says he doesn't ask us to jump through a whole bunch of hoops and try to measure up and try to get over the barriers and overcome everything on our own. Instead, he says, I've taken care of everything. I've prepared the great feast. It's time for the wedding and the celebration. Get a taste of the good life, of real life. Not time to go and wash and then wash and then wash and keep coming back and keep feeling guilty and keep feeling incompetent and burdened. But now it's time to celebrate. The wedding feast is here. It's coming. Jesus is announcing the era of grace. The era where he says, no longer do you go back and forth and wash and wash and wash. But now you trust. Now you believe. Now you follow me as I have taken care of everything. What is it that God is doing? He's saying, I don't want to relate to you in some distant, far-off way with all of these rituals and rites between us. He wants to come to us and relate to us mind to mind, heart to heart, soul to soul, with that close and intimacy of a groom taking his bride and being married. And sometimes we say, well, we would never go back to that. We would never go back to those kind of rituals. Never go back to washing for purity, literally, and water. But we do it. We have those things that we put up, the barriers for people to enter into community, the barriers that we have between us and God. Do you know what one of them is really common? That sometimes when you do something wrong, when you do something that your conscience tells you you shouldn't have done, and you think, well, I want to go back to God. I want to have that right relationship again. But I feel like he needs some cool down time. Like tomorrow I'll get good with God, because tonight I'm sure he's angry with me. He doesn't want to see me. He doesn't want to talk to me. He doesn't want to communicate. We put up this barrier and say, oh, there's got to be some, you know, have you ever experienced that? After some time when I feel a little bit better and God's not so mad, then I can pray again and then we can be close again. You know, we put up for barriers for people in terms of their morality. Well, Christians don't do that. We do it with the way that we think and with philosophies and with all sorts of things. Whatever we build up, a barrier. Sometimes we even do it in the name of defending the gospel. Well, we're defending the gospel. We're doing what's right, and so we're putting up this barrier. But don't be confused. Whenever we put barriers for people to come to God, we're not defending the gospel. We're actually doing the opposite. We're keeping them out. Defending the gospel is offering the beautiful gift of Jesus Christ and his grace. And so how does Jesus do this? How does he take down those barriers? The second symbolism that Jesus uses when it comes to wine is for his own blood. And he will, before he goes to the cross, he will give his disciples wine and say, this is my blood of the new covenant. This is the new way through which we relate, through the cross. As Christians, we go back to the cross over and over and over because we are reminded that it is through the shed blood of Jesus Christ, his sacrifice, him standing in our place, that we are forgiven. That's how we get rid of our guilt. That's how we get rid of our incompetence and our burden. He says, I've taken it for you. What does it mean to follow Jesus? It means to follow him into this era of grace. And then to see that he's taking care of everything. But what about all these barriers, all these standards that I need to live up to, that I need to achieve in order to be lovable, to be accepted? Jesus says, no, I've done it for you. My wedding's different. The wedding of religion has run dry. It doesn't cut it. But at my wedding, there's wine. There's grace. Taste it. This is how we relate. He says, I want to create a new inclusive community filled with joy and love through which a new kind of society will be created. Inclusive, not exclusive. Do you know, in religion, when we put up all of these standards, we become exclusive because we say, if you can't rise to the standard, if you can't get there, then you're excluded. Jesus takes that out. You know, sometimes in our society, I think it's crazy that Christianity is marked as exclusive. It's the one religion that's exclusive, but it's so inclusive. Jesus says anyone can be a follower. Anyone. All you have to do is accept it. All you have to do is accept the gift. You don't have to measure up. You don't have to be born from a certain family. You don't have to be so successful. You don't have to be perfect. I'll take care of all that. You just accept the gift. It's the era of grace. That's what this wine is all about. He wants a society where sorrow is replaced with joy. This is what the prophets talked about in this time when the Messiah would come. One that's governed by love and true relationship. A world where even death is conquered. Tears are wiped away. A community where Jesus, the groom, and his bride, the church, come together to create a world of flourishing. That we might bring heaven to this earth. That's what we're working towards. By the grace of God, by the working of his Holy Spirit. And he goes on, Jesus goes on to say that he would die for this kind of marriage. He would die to have this kind of relationship with us. And he does. Jesus says at his wedding, there will be wine. It will not run dry. Did you see how much wine there was? These huge, huge jars. 6 stone jars, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. There's enough for everybody. It's not going to run out. You know, this isn't just about your relationship with God. Jesus says, follow me. Follow me to grace. Follow me and I'll show you that I've taken everything. I've taken care of everything. Just accept it. But it's not just for me personally. It's not just for you personally. And this is the neat thing about weddings, especially Jewish weddings in the first century. Tim Keller, he said this, the purpose of a marriage was not primarily the happiness of the two individuals, but instead to bind the community together and to raise the next generation. In other words, the purpose of marriage was the good of the commonwealth. This is what he's saying. In their marriages, you know, in our marriages today, we sometimes think the day is all about just the two people standing up and getting married. They've fallen in love. They've come together. They're committing to live together for their entire lives. That's wonderful. We cheer them on. It's for them. But in a Jewish wedding in the first century, everybody realized that what is good for them, this couple coming together, being married, is really good for everybody. Because it shows this great solidarity. It's two people saying, we're coming together now for the good of not only our family, but for our entire community. We're going to raise up a generation. It's the strength of the community. It's this idea of we're going to help things flourish. For all of us. That's why the parties were so big. That's why the whole villages came out to see these weddings and to participate and to party, because it wasn't just for two people. It was the whole community saying, this is good for us. This is going to build us stronger together. Them getting married helps all of us because of how they're going to live and how they're going to act. And so what does it look like for us to realize that Jesus has invited us to his wedding and to partner with him? For all of us, it's going to look different. Your sphere of influence, what you do and how you do it. But there's a transferable principle, and here's one of them. Instead of building barriers, we break them down. Instead of building barriers for people, making it hard for them to find community, making it hard for them to find God, we instead take the religious paradigm that says, you must do this in order to be accepted, and we flip it on its head and we say, you are accepted if you accept it. And so we look for those ways in our lives where we can take, even when we don't use the language of religion, but we take that paradigm of religion of trying to measure up on your own, and we flip it around and we offer people this revolutionary grace. We embrace Jesus' amazing revolution of grace. Here's some examples. Some of you, you've just started school. Some of you are here at MAC for the very first time. And you know what's on your mind the first couple of weeks? You're looking for a social circle. You want to fit in. Some of you maybe have already wondered about, what do I have to do to fit in? What do I have to do to make some friends? But what if instead you flip that around and you walked around your floor in your dorm and you found the one person on your floor who doesn't fit in and you befriended them? Some of us will find ourselves or have found ourselves as leaders in organizations, in our jobs, even in our church, What would it look like for us to make policies that include the excluded, the overlooked, the ignored? What would it look like for us in our leadership positions to be looking out for the people who are the outsiders? For whatever reason, have been pushed to the margins. We say, I could help with that. Some of us are or will be doctors, nurses, engineers, working in the service industry. Some of us are tradespeople. And we're seeking to create a certain standard of living for ourselves and for our families. But what if we looked at our job, our vocation, as a calling, not just to create a standard of life for yourself and your family, but for the people that you serve, for the people that you work with? What if in our jobs we stopped just trying to be self-promoters all the time, and instead we found ways to lift up others around us? What if we went to the people who don't have enough, and we fed them, and we clothed them, and we sat with them, and we visited them, and we showed them love the way that Jesus has showed us love? It'll be about investing in relationships with people who disagree with us, who live differently, who have different faiths and different lifestyles. Not to just bring them in and argue, but to welcome them into a loving relationship with our lives to show them what Jesus has done for us. And here's the amazing thing. You know, Jesus hasn't just invited us to attend his wedding. He asks us to be the bride, to partner with him, to join with him intimately, side by side, working alongside of him in mission, to embrace his revolution of grace, to be his hands and feet in the world. I said on Wednesday night, we had a whole group of students in here. It was packed, and many of you, I'm sure, were there. A bunch of you, at least, were there. And I'm going to repeat myself a little bit. But I think it's important to come back to what I said at the beginning, that sometimes we talk a lot about following Jesus. We do study groups about following Jesus. We teach about it, and we memorize verses about it, and we do all of those things. And sometimes we think the worst thing in the world is rebellion, and what sneaks past us is that with all of our mental energy, we talk and study and memorize about following Jesus, but fail to follow Jesus. When we follow Jesus, we follow him into grace. We follow him into his wedding, where he says, religion is run dry, but there's grace at my wedding, grace in our marriage. That's how we're going to live. This is really important to get. One of the most dangerous ways of thinking in our society, I think, for Christians, is that Christians attend church. Listen. Christians do not just attend church. Christians are the church. We are the church. We are the bride. We've been invited to this partnership. And Jesus says this is going to be good, not just for us, but for the world. Because we're going to go out. And what our relationship is based on, we're going to provide for our community, for the people around us. That's what our world needs, church. That's what our campus needs. That's what Westdale needs. It's what our neighborhood needs. It's what your families need, is for us to rise up and to be the church. Let us pray. Heavenly Father, it is such a good gift that you have called us into this kind of relationship. God, you've taken care of everything, and we thank you for that. We love you. God, I pray that by your Spirit, you might help us to live as your bride, that you might help us to shower grace upon everybody that we come into contact with. God, you are good. We love you. We thank you in Christ's name. Amen.